My father bled for them buildings, and these multiversal motherfuckers stole my goddamn house. What do you know about this? Now she rounds on Hong. It isn't something we, the other cities and I, have noticed elsewhere, he says slowly. Padmini stares at him incredulous. Have you even been looking? Paolo sighs heavily. There's a whiff of I told you so in it, but less than there probably should be. Paolo is too clearly exhausted for proper schadenfreude. Hong scowls at him, then shakes his head and says to all of them, before a city is born, it's nothing. Just buildings, people, and possibility. We've focused on actualities. So while you and the other cities have been doing business as usual, reacting, this thing has been planning preemptive strikes everywhere, Branka says. She's pacing on one side of the main gallery. On the other side of it, Brooklyn is nearly her mirror, pacing as well, though faster and with her arms crossed. Branka pokes at points on an imaginary map. Little corporate traps in every city, in case it comes to life. Infusions of cash here and there to weaken cities before they're born. Maybe keeping them from being born. She shakes her head as both Hong and Paolo stiffen. Clearly that possibility hadn't occurred to them. Either way, as soon as a city is born, the enemy has a foothold already. Manny's leaning on the wall next to the primary's portrait. Vanessa and Padmini have huddled together on one of the viewing benches, using Padmini's laptop to learn more of their enemy's corporate structure. It's branched and extensive, almost tentacular. But they're tracking it down. Everyone's let Paolo have the lone chair rolled in from the reception desk because he's looking only a little better, even though he's appropriated the rest of Vanessa's brigaderos and is chewing on them now and again, meditatively, as he listens. Vanessa sighs, resigned to the sacrifice. And the enemy has probably been waiting particularly for something like this city, Brooklyn says. She's still furious as she eyes Hong, but her anger has cooled a little and politician voices back. Manny suspects she is a terror in city council meetings. You said most cities are either nothing, completely vulnerable but of no value, or else they're alive, and the enemy wants them, but they're too tough to crack. We are stuck in between. The perfect target. Valuable and vulnerable. Paolo nods slowly. I told the summit that the enemy's behavior had changed. I had no idea it had taken on a human shape or that it could talk. That's new. But even without that, it's been smarter, more subtle, more malevolent. The last two cities to awaken before you, New Orleans and Port-au-Prince, were stillbirths, and neither should have happened. But the elder cities, and more than a few of the younger ones, didn't believe me. They implied that we young cities of the Americas might simply be awakening prematurely, before we have the strength to survive the process. His lip curls as he says this. Hong shakes his head, restlessly and angrily. The exchange has the feel of an old argument to many. The process has not changed for centuries, millennia, longer than recorded human history. Why would it change now? I don't know. Maybe something's happening that we don't know about. Something beyond this world. Some catalyst which has spurred the enemy to evolve. But we should have started investigating this before now. Paolo's hand has become a fist on his knee. His jaw is tight. I should have done it myself if you weren't going to. But I let you talk me into joining your complacency. Hong glares at him for a moment, a muscle flexing in his jaw. I just wanted you to be safe, he says finally, softly. Manny blinks in surprise at the shift in his tone. For a moment, Hong sounded almost human. But is that? Paolo smiles bitterly and spreads his arms. His meaning is clear, although his arms have healed and he's looking much better than when they first met him. He will not leave New York unscathed. What we are, he says to Hong with the same softness, is not a safe thing. No city is, even we whole ones. We can be sacked and set ablaze, drowned when a new dam is built, bombed into craters. We live for as long as our cities, and we have great power. But you were the one who told me to study history, and I did. I saw that very few cities have died peacefully. Hong winces. Paolo presses on, relentless. And I, for one, will not leave with my back to the wall, ruled by fear of death or of that creature. Hong just glares at him, but there's an undercurrent. Manny finds himself exchanging a sidelong glance with Branka. Is this what I think it is? Branka raises her eyebrows and purses her lips. It sure is fucking what we thought it was. When Hong does not reply, Paolo lets out a long, steadying sigh. Then he gets to his feet. He seems stronger, but he's still holding a hand to his lower ribs, where Padmini shoved him earlier. She notices this, Manny sees, but sets her jaw and lifts her chin, not sorry. Blame Hong and me for your misfortune, Paolo says to them. Blame the other cities, too, if that comforts you. But unlike all of you, I've seen a living city die. I don't want to see it again. New Orleans? Manny guesses. He's been wondering about Hurricane Katrina. Hong is the one to shake his head. I handled that one. There are often complications with smaller cities. So the summit was concerned enough to send someone more experienced in that case. He looks pointedly at Paolo. Then he sobers. So much went wrong there, however. Its avatar was shot in an attempted robbery. Before the birth. Indeed, before I even arrived. Pure bad luck, I thought. But then the hospital mishandled her chart and nearly killed her in surgery, and then they turned her out before she was fully recuperated because she was indigent. He shakes his head, muttering in Cantonese about barbaric American healthcare for a moment before returning to English. I gave her a place to stay, but she had no strength when the city tried to rise and the enemy came. The levees broke after she died, and rather than help, your media and incompetent leadership compounded the catastrophe at every turn. Then his frown deepens. But if the enemy was at work there, interfering somehow even before the city chose its champion? He trails off, visibly troubled. Paolo looks bleak. Port-au-Prince was mine to oversee. Manny winces despite himself. The earthquake. The one that killed a quarter of a million people. Then thousands more from cholera and mismanagement and foreign interference. Paolo nods, but does not elaborate. Then he lifts his chin. New York is much bigger than Port-au-Prince. It's surrounded on nearly every side by satellite cities and massive exurbs. This woman is looking for him, the primary, and having infested so many citizens with her essence, acting as her eyes and ears, she will eventually find him. And if you haven't awakened him by then... He shakes his head, and none of them speak for a moment. It's hard to argue with the tight-jawed tragedy in his face. Look, Brooklyn says. She sighs and leans against a wall. Without Staten Island, You can't ask us to sacrifice ourselves if we don't even know that it's going to work. If it takes dying to make her safe, I can pay that price. In a heartbeat. But I'm not going to leave my daughter motherless for nothing.
What if you go find Staten Island?
Vanessa's voice is hesitant. When they turn to her, she is sitting against the far wall of the room, knees drawn up and arms wrapped around them, looking tired and unhappy. Manny can guess why. He hasn't quite sussed out the relationship between Branka and Vanessa. Surrogate mother and daughter, superhero sidekick, or maybe just odd couple best friends. Love is love, however, and it probably bothers Vanessa a lot to know that she's going to lose Branka if they see this through.
What if all of you go to her and convince her to help?
It's the one thing you haven't tried, but it seems, I don't know, the obvious next step. It's true. Yet Manny finds himself disliking the idea, and for a moment he is flustered as to why. He's never been to Staten Island. What is this reluctance to go there? Is he afraid of an avatar who is clearly violent and might be crazy? That basically applies to all of them, himself more than most. Or is he somehow being affected by Manhattanites' collective distaste for the littlest, least loved borough? It's worth a try, Brooklyn says at last. She sounds reluctant, too. All of them look reluctant, which backs up Manny's theory. But no one objects. Hong rubs his eyes.
None of you seem to realize how urgent a matter this is. While we waste time with endless chatter, what's happening in this city is escalating rapidly. Each person infected infects others. Each new structure that grows unchecked infects many. It's clear that the enemy is building toward some goal, and I don't know what it is, but you need to stop it. Now, before it gets worse.
We are being urgent, Padmini snaps. A few days ago, I was doing coursework. Today, I'm actually standing here and not leaving while strangers try to convince me to kill myself. This is as fast as I get.
If we go to City Hall, Manny begins.
Padmini groans, and he glares at her, annoyed.
If we go now and can't wake the primary, we'll have wasted a lot of time. I think we should split up. Some of us go get Staten Island. The rest, see if we can do anything at City Hall, or just keep the primary avatar safe, if not.
Padmini blinks. Branka looks duly impressed.
Agreed. Surprised to hear it from you, but agreed.
Manny lets out a slow breath, attempting patience.
I want the primary to live. I haven't made any secret of that. But I can't see why you wouldn't, too, given what's at stake.
Branka snorts.
You're the one who's in love with him, Manahatta.
Not suicidally, Manny snaps, although he is also blushing.
What good does it do me to save his life and then die at his feet? I want more than that.
Jesus, he's gonna blow some blood vessels, but it's the truth.
I'm gonna fight for more than that.
That's almost sweet, Brooklyn says. She's smiling, albeit with a hint of sadness.
I hope you get what you want. I hope we all do.
Branka lets out a little tired sigh and shakes her head. To Manny, she says,
I take it you're Team City Hall.
Of course. She eyes Padmini.
You?
I don't want to go anywhere near City Hall, Padmini declares.
Team Staten Island, then,
Hong draws.
Since Sao Paulo should not return to that borough, he'll obviously have to...
He tenses mid-sentence. Paulo, too, frowns and turns, his eyes unfocusing. Manny's trying to figure out what's the matter. And then it hits all of them, too. A sinking sensation.
a strange gravitic dip, which is all the stranger because it does not exist in the real world, where there is light and time and space, and they all stand upon a floor. Something in the other place. Close, whatever it is.
What is... Padmini begins.
Paolo shakes his head, frowning.
Nothing I've ever felt,
Hong says. Branka groans softly, bending and grinding a fist into her midriff as if she's got heartburn.
Oh, I feel like I'm going to be sick.
Manny doesn't feel sickness, but he definitely feels something. An offness, a wrongness, an imminence. He looks down, his perception caught half in, half out of the real world, and frowns at a whispery rustle at the edges of his hearing. Why does it sound like there's something moving underneath us? And why is there something familiar about the sound? Branka looks at the floor too, and all of a sudden, her eyes widen.
Because there is. Rising toward us.
She grabs Vanessa and hauls the girl to her feet. Everybody out, now!
What? Why?
Asks Brooklyn, but she's moving. Then they can all feel it. Something is growing underneath the center. A layer of wrongness between them and the city's bedrock, interfering with the bond they should feel by simply standing on their home ground. Manny curses and grabs Paolo, since he's nearest. Paolo does not protest, though he stumbles a little, shaky on his feet. Vanessa comes up on Paolo's other side, however, and between the two of them, they're able to keep up as the rest pelt for the door. Branka swings a little right as they're hurrying down a corridor so that she can yank on a fire alarm panel. An old-fashioned clanging bell starts to go off. Manny remembers her mentioning that there are artists who sometimes spend the night in the center upstairs. But even as the alarm goes off, the building's lights flicker. They begin to hear a sound, a whispering susurrus, a many-layered slither, rising into a growl beneath them. And they're not running nearly fast enough. Manny tries to think, tries not to be afraid, and then for some reason, he finds himself thinking about his one experience of being on a subway. That rush between express stops, hurtling through the dark in the belly of a gleaming metal sheath. That sense of endless, perilous, chaotic speed. It isn't much. He's not in his home borough. Still, abruptly, there is a stir of city energy, and the ghostly shape of a subway car shimmers into visibility around them as they run. Manny's feet seem to lift off the ground, and he zooms forward, fast as a train's acceleration. Padmini yelps, and Branka curses as they're all swept along. Then the world rushes past with a whiff of rat droppings and the blare of an industrial horn, and suddenly they have shot through the front windows of the center and its shutters too, their bodies briefly as intangible as the ghost train. Then they're on the sidewalk across the street from the center, stumbling and crying out as the train screeches to a halt there.
Holy shit, Vanessa blurts. That was wilder than the cyclone.
But as the phantom subway fades away and they turn back to the Bronx Arts Center, a column of white erupts from the ground around the building and flings itself skyward. It is not completely here, not quite in this world. For a moment, they can still see the center within the rising mass, and the building itself seems undisturbed. But the column rises to quickly become thousands of white tendrils, each more massive than the flare that Manny once battled in an FDR fast lane. They interlock as they grow, enveloping the entire block in seconds. Manny can only stare, reverberating with the same stunned horror as the others while the tangled wall of white rises before them. 50 feet high, 60, and the tendrils have begun to tighten their weave and solidify together into a singular mass. 80 feet high. A tower.
Oh, no. No. No.
Branka breathes as they crane their necks, watching the thing form. It will be as high or higher than the strange arch over at Hunt's Point. It's already clear.
The key holders. I don't think any of them could have.
I have to get them out.
And she actually starts back across the street before Brooklyn and Vanessa both drag her back.
You can't,
says Hong. It's softer than Hong usually speaks, but no less brutally true for that. Bronca shudders all over and groans, anguished. We should go. Padmini is shaking visibly, her eyes wide and distraught. We shouldn't be this close.
Manny heartily agrees.
Traffic on the street in front of the center is a wreck. Cars veering away and stopping in the middle of the street, others speeding up and getting the hell out of Dodge. None of the drivers can see the tower, but they're all reacting to it regardless, sensing the presence of an interloper. Out of this chaos, however, a familiar yellow shape suddenly makes a U-turn and comes rapidly hurtling down the street before screeching to a halt in front of them. It's a checker cab. Someone's put a sign in the passenger window with prominent handwritten letters, "Not a real cab, do not hail." The sign falls into the cab, however, as a woman leans across the passenger seat to hand crank the window down. She stares at Manny, and Manny stares back.
Oh, I fucking knew it, says Madison.
It's unbelievable. Well, no, it's not. It's the city. In spite of everything, Manny can't help grinning, though he suspects he looks a little hysterical.
Small world.
Is it? She scrunches her face. Today she's wearing a t-shirt that reads, I'm not perfect, but I'm from New York, and that's kind of the same thing. Are you gonna do the whole ride 'em cowboy thing again? Because you probably should. She jabs a thumb toward the center.
No.
There's only one reason for the city to have sent them a ride.
Can you take us to City Hall Station?
Madison rolls her eyes. I'm not even going to ask how you knew I was headed that way anyway.
Get in, damn it!
Okay, hang on.
Manny straightens.
Do we have another car for the Staten Island group?
Bronca tears her eyes from the awful thing that has enveloped her center and then rummages through her pockets. Her movements are shaky, her expression shocky, and Manny doesn't blame her. But she sighs in relief and pulls a set of keys from one pocket. There's an electronic key fob on it.
Yeah, mine.
I'll go with you to Staten Island then,
Brooklyn says to her. She looks at the checker oddly.
You guys got a ride, I guess.
Yeah,
Manny says.
It is a need now, the pull toward City Hall that sits in his breast. Everything in him that understands strategy, violence, warfare, is certain that this tower, this direct attack, is a sign.
The woman in white has abandoned pretense. She's making her move, and they aren't ready. Manny's going to City Hall, even if none of the others want to go with him. Paolo says to Manny, as if hearing this thought,
I'll go with you.
He's still not looking great, but he moves with tolerable speed to climb through the cab's rear passenger door, nodding politely to Madison inside. With a sudden gasp that makes all of them jump, Vanessa slaps at her pockets, then groans in relief as she finds her car keys too.
Oh my God, thought I was gonna be walking home.
I can also carry. Bronca makes a growling sound.
The only place you're going is home.
They all jump again, except Brooklyn. It was a mom voice, sharp and incontrovertible. Brooklyn just nods grimly and takes out her phone. Vanessa stares at Bronca like she's crazy.
Oh, B, come on. You're gonna need all the...
Shut the fuck up.
Van Bronca gestures at what used to be the Bronx Art Center. The tower is still growing, although not as quickly as before. It's gonna be taller than anything else in the Bronx, as far as Manny can tell. And it is breathing, he sees, in fitful, arrhythmic heaves.
or pulsing. Or maybe that's its malleable, tendril-flecked surface just randomly twitching. The sound of it is poorly maintained nails on a cracked chalkboard. He finds himself humming tunelessly in a futile effort to drown it out. He can't look at it for long, either, which makes Bronca's next words painfully ironic.
Look at that shit. Do you know what it would do to me if you were in there?
Vanessa blinks at her for a startled moment, then wilts a little.
Yeah, okay. I just...
She sighs.
Wanted to help.
Bronca lets out a shaky breath and goes to her, gripping the younger woman's shoulders.
You can't help us. And right now, you're just something else I have to worry about.
She thinks they're going to fail, Manny realizes. Bronca believes they will be killed by the enemy and that the city will then be struck by some catastrophe. She's sending Vanessa away so that the girl will survive whatever happens. Vanessa looks hurt by Bronca's words for a moment, and then she scowls.
No, you did not just try the whole reverse psychology thing on me. Do I look stupid? If you want me to go that bad, just say it outright. Don't pretend you don't want me around.
I want you to go,
Bronca says. Her voice is flint. Vanessa falters and falls silent, then grimaces.
Well, shit.
Okay. After a moment, she begins backing toward her own car, though she's clearly not happy about it.
Be if you get killed or eaten or squiggleized or whatever the fuck, I'm gonna kill you, she says. I'm gonna follow you to the happy hunting ground and slap the shit out of you.
But then she turns and runs toward her car, which seems to be a good ways down the block. Bronca looks torn between sorrow at Vanessa's leaving and relief that the girl doesn't think less of her for the attempt at harshness.
We talked about those stereotypes, didn't we?
Bronca calls after her.
Didn't we?
Vanessa lifts a middle finger in farewell. Bronca gazes after her for a moment, smiling a little, though her lips are tight. Then she takes a deep breath and beckons to Brooklyn and the rest.
Gonna be a tight squeeze in my car, she says. And somebody else is gonna have to pay the Verrazano toll. I don't have any cash. That's all electronic now,
Brooklyn says, though she is distracted. Manny can see that her phone is dialing someone.
They snap your license on camera, send your bill later. Well, whoop-de-doo for the surveillance state. I'm right here.
She uses the key fob to unlock a Jeep a few cars down. The others follow her. Padmini has been furiously texting someone. A moment later, the phone rings, and they all hear Aishwara's voice shouting in rapid Tamil while Padmini winces and tries to explain that the family needs to get out of town. Brooklyn says,
Yeah, Dad, like we talked about, my aide will be there to pick you up in 30 minutes. Tell him to drive like you know an earthquake is coming.
I love you too.
She hangs up, and then she alone glances back at Manny. There's so much guarded fear in her expression that it makes him ache inside. She isn't afraid for any of them, of course. They are nothing to each other, the boon companions of less than 3 days. Still, on their collective success or failure does her family's fate now rest. Words like goodbye or good luck would just feel too final. In token of which, Brooklyn finally just turns away and hurries after the others to Bronca's car. Manny stares after her for a moment longer, registering only belatedly that he alone among them has no family or loved ones to worry about. Except New York itself. Himself. He gets in the cab with Paolo, and Madison pulls away from the curb quickly, as eager to get away from the tower as any of them. Now Manny can focus, at last.
On my way,
he murmurs very softly to the air.
Paolo glances at him but says nothing. He knows exactly who Manny's talking to.
See you soon.
And as Vanessa anxiously drives away from the others and tries to convince herself that surprising her asshole father down in Philly really is a better choice than staying to face an interdimensional apocalypse, something in her backseat gulps very softly. Chapter 14. The Gauntlet of Second Avenue. It starts as soon as they're in the car. Bronca takes out her phone so that she can use navigation. She squints at the thing as she always does, laboriously pecking out letters and numbers with one finger until Queen says, "I'll do it," and reaches up from the back seat to take the phone from her. "Just start heading for Staten Island." It's no worse than what she's put up with from Vanessa, but Queen's isn't Vanessa.
"Ask before you take things from people, heathen."
"I'm just trying to be efficient. I need a destination address."
Her fingers fly across the keyboard with the uncanny speed of anyone younger than 30. Bronca starts driving. Since Brooklyn's on the phone in the front passenger seat, Queens looks at Hong.
"I'm Hong Kong," he snaps.
"Oh, yes, I guess you wouldn't know."
Queens opens out the map as Bronca starts driving.
"But can you at least point to where you found Paolo? She's probably somewhere near there."
While she and Hong haggle over the approximate last known location of the Staten Island Avatar, Brooklyn gets off the phone again. She's been talking more quietly this time, and Bronca hasn't bothered her because she recognized that tone and pitch of voice. That's how parents sound when they're trying to say goodbye to their kids, possibly for the last time. It's what she probably should be saying to her own son. But Machish is in his 30s and lives in California. And frankly, that's likely to turn into an argument, which she doesn't have the strength for at the moment. And orphaning a grown man is an entirely different thing from doing it to a 14-year-old girl. If anything, Bronca wishes she could say farewell to her grandchild, due to be born in 3 months or so. But maybe it's best that she be only a mystery to the child, and not a tragedy when they tell stories of her. In the wake of her phone call, Brooklyn gazes out the window for a while brooding, and Bronca lets her. Not much that can be said in a moment like this, but eventually she tries.
"Sending her to her dad?"
Brooklyn snorts with such bitterness that Bronca immediately knows it was the wrong thing to ask.
"Her father's dead, so I hope not."
Ouch.
"Drugs?"
Brooklyn turns to glare at her.
"Cancer."
"Ah, shit." Bronca sighs.
"Look, I didn't mean... I just used to listen to your music sometimes, and you always talked about getting with guys who were dealers or bangers or, you know."
"Yeah, a lot of dudes like that are just doing what they have to do to take care of people they care about, which makes them more decent than your average nice upstanding predatory lender or whatever. But regardless, what I talked about in my music wasn't always what I was doing in real life. Shit, I thought only white people believed everything they hear in rap is real." She shakes her head and stares at the road. Bronca feels herself getting heated. It's the wrong place and the wrong time and the wrong target. And she's old enough to know that she's only sniping at Brooklyn because this is something she can control, unlike the rest of their whole awful situation. But even knowing all this, well, Bronca's never going to be a very good wise elder, if she even makes it that far.
"Yeah? It's not real?"
She keeps her eyes on the road, but her hands have tightened on the steering wheel.
"I remember some of your lyrics that were pretty fucking real. And if a bitch tries to hit it, I'll gut her with my gat. You remember that one?"
Brooklyn is groaning and angry laughing at once.
"Oh, here we go.
I apologized for those lyrics years ago, publicly. And I donated $1,000 to the Ali Forney Center. You think that makes up for it? You know how many queer kids get stabbed or shot to death?
She takes a corner to get them lined up for the Bruckner Expressway and slews a little, forcing her to cross-control the wheel more than usual to get them back on track.
Please, please get into a catastrophic car accident.
Hung sighs from the back seat.
Destroy half the city in a single collision, do all the enemy's work for her, then I can go home.
Bronca sets her jaw, fuming, but in the silence, Brooklyn lets out a long, slow breath.
I know an apology don't make up for it, she says.
She's slipped back into her old school Brooklyn accent, dropping the politician voice, and somehow this eases a little of Bronca's temper. Neither Brooklyn is false, but this one feels a little truer to MC Free, and that's the part of her Bronca's got beef with.
I know it don't okay. I damn sure got called a dyke enough myself just for stepping into a ring that dude rappers thought was theirs by default. Motherfuckers tried to rape me all because I didn't fit into what they thought a woman should be. And I passed that shit on. I know I did. But I got better. I had some friends slap some sense into me. And I listened when they did. And I figured out that the dudes were fucked in the head, so maybe it wasn't the best idea to imitate them. Shit, back then, most of us were just... bullshitting, right? High on the hype. Cooning for a record deal and suburban white boy dollars. I just... Fuck.
It's done. Bronca looks at her, reading the deep weariness and sorrow of her. And sincerity. So she drives on in silence for a while, letting the ethers settle before she finally says,
sorry about the drugs.
That was a racist. Technically prejudiced because the power dynamics are basically flat, but she grins in an attempt to ease the awkwardness.
I have black friends, also aunties and grandmothers.
She can almost hear Brooklyn roll her eyes. Still, after a moment, quietly,
I did lose a lot of friends to drugs, so I'm a little
touchy, yeah.
Me too. I am the Bronx.
An answering snort followed by a tired, dry,
and I am Brooklyn.
You fight crime,
says Queens, beaming. Brooklyn turns and looks at her, until she sits back and shuts up. They're taking a route that should get them there fastest, even though it means paying a pirate's ransom in tolls. But right before they're supposed to transfer from the Bruckner to FDR, Bronca's phone bleeps a warning.
There's an accident or something on FDR,
Queens says, frowning, as she leans forward to peer at it. She reaches forward and taps something.
There's an alternate route through the city that seems clear.
Fine, Bronca says, and follows the directions issued by the bland computer lady voice of the navigation app.
Through the city is actually faster than the FDR? Brooklyn asks.
Huh, must be a hell of an accident. I don't think.
Bronca's been half listening to the radio. It's just on for noise, but the DJ mentions the FDR, so Bronca turns the radio up.
And now authorities have actually shut down the FDR drive,
the guy is saying, sounding incredulous.
Police are describing this as a spontaneous demonstration because apparently there are no permits on file. But news agencies in the city have received a statement from the group sent several hours before the protest began. They call themselves the Proud Men of NYC. Not to be confused with NYC Pride. This group is right-wing and has been linked to violent incidents such as...
The report goes on for a bit, and then there is a brief audio clip. Bronca hears many voices, all of them male, as far as she can tell, chanting indistinctly with police sirens in the background.
We're here to let New York know,
says one young man's voice, shaky with movement and adrenaline.
We took over Greenpoint and Williamsburg, and now it's time for Manhattan to see that the men of our group are not going to take no shit no more.
Someone jostles him.
Dude, come on, these shoes are new. The men of New York City aren't going to take any more shit. And feminist, liberal nonsense.
There's a jumble of words that Branka doesn't get. Something about being replaced.
To be replaced.
And feminist, liberal nonsense. It's okay to be a white man. We're not gonna feel guilty about our white dicks. And you're gonna know how it feels.
The clip cuts off abruptly. Back to the DJ, who is now chuckling with palpable unease.
Well, hopefully we didn't just earn ourselves an FCC violation there. Anyway, folks, stay away from FDR Drive for now, unless you want to park and look at the view.
The station's music resumes. Brooklyn stares at the console. Are you kidding me? A what? A racist white dude march? In New York? At almost midnight? What are they trying to do? They're not even going to disrupt the city's traffic much. Well, they're disrupting us pretty fucking well. Branka mutters, turning onto Second Avenue. Bit, NYPD isn't even gonna stop them. Or else they'll arrest any counter-protesters or people these guys pull out of their cars for a beatdown. But a march of angry white men, though, Queens says worriedly. That's never good. It most definitely is not. And Branka muses that it's damned strange for New York, which has its share of racists, God knows. The city's special in a lot of ways, but not that one. Generally, however, the ones in the city are content to live and let live, as one must in any major city, especially if one doesn't want to get knocked the fuck out on the subway. Like New Orleans, Kong murmurs, so softly that Branka almost doesn't hear him. What? In the rearview mirror, his stone face has gotten stonier. What killed New Orleans was bad luck, he said. A series of terrible coincidences. Institutions breaking down. Old hatreds taking new form. Subcultures choosing just the wrong moment to make a drastic change. So I thought at the time. Then Branka gets it. You think this march is what, bankrolled by Better New York? To force us onto a different route? I have no idea. But city avatars are generally quite fortunate. Helpful coincidences fall into our laps with great frequency. It's part of what we are. How our cities help us. Your city is weak. Branka sees him shake his head in the rear view. Or perhaps something else is working even harder to counter its efforts. There's nothing they can say to that. Dread works best in complete silence. They hit Second Avenue at Spanish Harlem, working-class neighborhood, late on a weeknight. Branka's unsurprised to see that the streets are mostly empty. Only the bodegas stand open, sentinels of the city that never sleeps, and occasionally needs milk at 2 a.m. Gentrification here has taken the form of endless coffee shops. For the last few blocks, these have been indie places proudly touting their locally roasted pour-overs, all with different decor and sign fonts. Then comes the proof that it's all over for the neighborhood's original character. They pass a Starbucks on the corner. Branka thinks. She can't be sure. Because it's so covered in white tendrils and stiffer projections that she can barely see its logo or facade. It's like some kind of animal. The overlapping moving layers of white tendrils have given it a kind of brindle-furred appearance, blurring the building's overall boxy shape. It's a typical New York multi-use building. Ground floor business, apartments above. The apartment portion has a few tendrils on each level, but nothing like the monster down below. And when that monster abruptly ripples all over like water and forms a huge, inhuman, vast-mouthed face, Bronca swerves. It's reflex. There aren't many other cars on the street, but two taxis and an Uber immediately honk, because sudden swerves do not mesh well with Manhattan traffic patterns at speed. When they've passed the Starbucks, Bronca looks at it in her rearview, while Brooklyn slews around in her seat to stare, and Queens does the same. "What the fuck?" Queens says. She's hyperventilating a little. Then her phone rings. She answers it. They all hear Aishwara again, calmer than before, but still sounding tense as she asks some question. "I can't talk right now, I'm so sorry," Queens murmurs before hanging up on her. Hong mutters something in Chinese, then, "You need to ready a construct if you have to fight." "Oh, fuck!" Bronca cries. And this time, she has to not only swerve, but lunge into the bike lane, as on the right side of the street, another Starbucks that is covered in glittering white feathers suddenly hops a little out onto Second Avenue at them. The building attached to it lurches a little, but Bronca can see that it's happening, but not happening. Something of the building, its solidity is still there. Even as in the other world, it becomes a monster and comes at them. This particular Starbucks must have late open hours. Bronca can see human figures through the skin of the creature, blank-eyed as they sit at its window bar to sip their drinks, unperturbed by its lumbering attack. And two blocks farther down, Bronca can see another building, this one veining colossal white porcupine spikes as it readies itself to pounce. The car that Bronca just cut off in order to escape the bird Starbucks is leaning on its horn, the driver furious. Bronca doesn't blame him. She pulls ahead to the next block and then stops at the curb, shaking as she grips the wheel and catches her breath. She keeps an eye on the bird Starbucks in the rearview, but the thing seems unable to go more than a few feet from its foundations. After glaring at Bronca in the mirror and snapping its glass door beak at her once or twice, it drools foul-looking coffee-ground sludge before grudgingly backing into its former position. The furious driver pulls around her, gesturing out the window and yelling something in the universal language of "fuck you, learn to drive," before heading off. "It's every Starbucks," Brooklyn says, squinting down the street. "Not just them. Look!" Queens points at a Dunkin' Donuts that is heavily overgrown with corkscrewing wire-like stuff. From a distance, it looks like a massive white fro. Across the street is some kind of cafe that has developed a silky white chin curtain with scraggles over the sidewalk. "That au bon pain there looks like it's going to start telling jokes at open mic improv any minute now." "Those aren't actively chasing us down the street like the damn Starbucks, though." Bronca shakes her head, peering down the length of Second Avenue. "I could try Laxa Park, but the real problem is that there's one of those things on every other corner, especially near Grand Central and the other tourist spots." Fleetingly, she finds herself wishing that they'd brought Manhattan with them. Maybe he could have somehow secured the route against this. "This doesn't make sense." Queens cranes her neck to see the porcupine thing on the next block. It's very still, but Bronca doesn't trust it. It's also one of the newer buildings on the block and might be more flexible than the older, unrenovated bird Starbucks. "Starbucks has been in the city for years. It has to be part of New York by now."
"Starbucks is everywhere," Hong rumbles. "All over my city, too. Big chain stores make a city less unique, more like every other place. We do not have time for your breakdown, Bronx."
Bronca freezes, then turns around in her seat.
"Disrespect me again," she snaps.
"You will be walking back to JFK from that corner right there. Hope nothing eats you on the way."
There must be enough true fury in her voice. He looks away and takes a deep breath. With brittle, exaggerated politeness, he says,
"Apologies. Do you have an alternative plan?"
She's not really mollified, but they've got other problems. In answer to his question, she sets her jaw and pulls the car away from the curb.
What are you going to...
Queens begins.
I'm going to drive like a motherfucking New Yorker is what I'm going to do.
Ronka snarls. And then she cuts off a truck and accelerates to 50. Queens cries out, and Bronca hears her scrambling for the seatbelt that she should have already had on. The truck blats an air horn at Bronca.
Honking's illegal. You're gonna get a ticket,
she shouts, but she's grinning in spite of herself. It's been a shitty few days, so at full speed she rockets down 2nd Avenue, cutting neat zigzags across the traffic, threading the needle between two Land Rovers, shooting through an intersection just as its light turns red. Hong curses Cantonese behind her. A right lane car pass, an impatient swerve around a slow-moving pedestrian. There's a police speed monitor on one side of the road down by 23rd, reminding drivers that the speed limit in the city is 25, and it blinks a baleful red 70 as she blasts past. But the Starbucks monsters can't touch them. After 10 blocks, silvery flickers of light have begun to appear around Bronca's Jeep, licking at the edges of her vision. After 15, it's not a peripheral thing anymore. A sheath of white light surrounds them. A snake-like Starbucks lunges out of the lobby of a chain hotel, its ghostly stretched wide mouth open, and just past its translucent white gullet, a tired-looking barista slumps on his knees, scrubbing up a spilled iced something. But the snake's spectral teeth bounce off Bronca's car as if it's tried to bite a rock, and Bronca blazes on. The cops don't stop her or even seem to see her. Hong and Queens have sat back, gripping the armrests and making sure their seatbelts are buckled. Brooklyn, bless her, helps by shouting out the window at any car that looks as if it's about to impede their route.
Are you blind, motherfucker?
And so on. Adding to the construct, Bronca now realizes, blending the power of their two boroughs into one massive preemptive wave of get the fuck out of the way. Now the sheath of energy is bullet-shaped, and long enough that it physically shunts aside cars that are going too slow or about to cut them off. Bronca's grinning like a clown. Brooklyn's laughing too, giddy with it. It's beautiful. 2nd Avenue ends at Houston, so the GPS starts directing them on a more zigzagging route toward Brooklyn. Now they're in the Lower East Side. The only Starbucks in the area is a tired, old, fish-like thing on Delancey, which can't even make it past its own curb when it tries to flop at them. Bronca does the speed limit past that one, just as an extra unspoken, fuck you. The Williamsburg Bridge is gone. Long may it rest. There's something in the water past all of the warnings and roadblocks and memorial photo walls. Something white and heaving and organic that seems to fill the entirety of the East River and enormous enough to tower over the lone support pylon that remains standing in the bridge's wake. As they pass Delancey, the white thing slowly undulates, even as they watch. It radiates a sickly greenish-white light that hurts Bronca's eyes, and she swerves off Delancey sooner than she might have because of it.
Oh, no, Queens murmurs in a soft, horrified voice. That's the thing that broke the bridge. It's real, but I didn't think it would still be there.
No one answers her, mostly because there's nothing to say. Instead, Brooklyn taps Bronca's phone. I'm adjusting the route to take us over the Brooklyn Bridge. No chain stores on the BQE. Yeah, okay, Bronca says. Then she pulls over to the curb again while they're on one of the smaller streets where this is still possible.
What? I hate driving in Brooklyn, she says, unbuckling her seatbelt. Handle your own damn borough.
Brooklyn laughs in spite of herself and gets out to switch places with her. You want to drive once we get to Staten Island? She asks Queens while they buckle in.
I don't drive, remember?
Queens looks sheepish.
Oh, right, forgot. How can you not know how to drive?
Hong asks, scowling.
Because usually, New Yorkers don't need to,
Bronca snaps at him. Not that she's any big fan of Queens, either. But it's habit to defend other women when men start ragging on them. And the fact that Queens is New York and Hong Kong is an out-of-towner just adds impetus.
Now shut up again. I was starting to not hate you.
The rest of the ride to the island is uneventful. Still, they all see them as they crest the Verrazano, which gives them a good view of the island. More towers. Two of them, at least. Though there's also a humped, nodule-covered thing in the distance that is either a really ugly stadium or yet another weird structure. Brooklyn slows down in Staten Island, not just because the streets here are narrower and there are a lot of cops around, but also because they can sense the avatar of Staten Island now that they've entered her domain. It's a strange feeling, but not altogether different from that new deep awareness they all have of the primary, which has lingered in them since they did their little group vision thing. It's as if there is a lodestone in their heads, sort of, with one end that points toward City Hall instead of north. The other points toward somewhere in the middle of Staten Island, an area that Hong pointed out to them on Google Maps, which is called Heartland Village. To get there, they must drive through a sprawling, hilly woodland, which that night is full of strange shadows. They're tense the whole way, watching the spaces between the trees, ready for anything. Nothing happens, but the unease lingers, getting worse, Sprunka notes, as they move deeper into the island's territory. Before long, they've pulled onto a neat little street where all the houses are cute two-story single families interspersed with semi-attached double houses. They are eerily similar in frame, these homes, though they've all got different paint jobs and siding and hedges. It's the suburbs, where conformity trumps comfort. Bronca's never liked places like this. Here they stop, however, because growing from the lawn of the house that probably belongs to their target, there is another white tower. That's a bad sign in itself, Bronca thinks. But as they start toward the house, white, curling, vine-like things appear out of nowhere, erupting from the soil and spinning down from the nearby tower and thickening and drawing together and solidifying, forming a human-sized tangle. Until the woman in white stands before them, arms folded, legs braced apart, and feet planted solidly on the lawn. This time, she has a mane of white hair that is long and raggedly straight. Very 70s chic, which matches the pointed, narrow, slow-eyed face that she currently wears. Incongruously, she's wearing booty shorts and a loose tank top. She looks like an evil mid-career Joni Mitchell. And this time she isn't alone. Looming out of the hedges behind her and from the neighbor's lawns, Bronca can see huge, attenuated, spindly shadows, which had at first seemed like just ordinary castings from the street lamps. It quickly becomes clear that they are something more when they begin to sway and move. There are sounds accompanying this movement. A lilting series of hoots, dry cracklings like the breaking of tree limbs, faint, low vibrations as something heavy but mostly unseen humps across the lawn sods. No pretty paint people here. Bronca almost misses them after she gets a not good look at a few of the shadow things.
"I can't see anything well," Queen says in a hushed tone. "Why can't I see them? I have to look off to the side. When I look at them directly..."
"Yeah," Bronca says. "I'm getting the sense that she's got new tricks every time she shows up."
Something to her left is swaying from side to side, though occasionally it stops and jerks upward in an awkward, vaguely amphibianesque movement. It's not close, hiding amid the hedges of one of the neighboring houses. But she really doesn't like that movement for some reason. It feels like the thing is practicing for a jump.
"None of this is how it should be," Hong says.
He's got a hand inside his suit jacket, grasping something out of sight.
"She has always been enormous, monstrous, attacking when a city is newborn and weak. Not human in shape, not speaking, Never this.
When you assume, says the woman in white, you make an ass out of you and me.
And all of a sudden, all four of them are yanked into the other place, where time and space have no meaning, and all of them bristle and vein with cranes and rusting girders and blurry Beaux-Arts glass. Massive Hong Kong looms at their backs. But this is not his city. Branka can see Manhattan's skyscrapers better, even though he's a little apart from them as well. Staten Island is here, too, somehow apart from the rest of them, and more subdued in size and shine, even though they stand within her borders. But between her and the rest of them stands something else. Another city, positioned as if to protect Staten Island. It's not any part of New York. It's enormous, bigger than all of them combined, and everything about it feels so wrong that its very closeness makes Branka flinch back, raising construction scaffolds in automatic defense. The new city is precisely circular in its footprint. Its towers gleam, its neighborhoods sprawl, its parks teem with animals and trees. But all of it is wrong. Those aren't towers, Branka thinks in rising horror. They're breathing. Those aren't buildings. I don't know what the fuck. She can't think. It's too close. Just the sight of it hurts. And every skewed-angled building, precisely marked street, and suppurating organism of this city gleams in brilliant, perfect, unnaturally bright white. They snap back into people's space, are thrown back, and there every one of them stands stunned by the awful, nauseating realization that the woman in white is a city, another city, a monstrous city from nowhere in or even close to this universe, whose very streets are inimical to their entire universe.
Welcome, avatars of New York, says the woman in white, as they stand frozen in the near shadow of her tower. Her eyes, acid yellow this time, not even pretending to be a human color, flick at Hong and away dismissively. And Hong Kong! Is it time for the final confrontation, then? Shall we play some exciting music? Shall I deliver a villainous monologue?
It is an utterly delighted laugh that sends chilly fingers dancing down Branka's spine. That's the laugh of someone who's pretty sure they've already won.
Hong is breathing hard, Branka notices, and there is a deeply shaken note in his voice as he speaks. He is a city of deep history and tradition, underneath its bright modern trappings and rebel reputation. It's clear he does not take well to things that defy his understanding of the world.
This can't be, he murmurs. We've fought you since the beginning. How can you be? I don't understand.
Obviously. The woman in white rolls her eyes and shifts to stand akimbo, leaning on one leg with her hand on her hip.
Well, smart amoebas are still just amoebas, aren't they?
Branka is still trying to reconcile Crazy Daisy Duke with the prim, sophisticated Dr. White, even though every newfound instinct within her affirms that they are the same person. Who isn't a person at all.
What the hell are you then?
She demands, hoping that her voice doesn't shake.
Really?
Really?
The woman in white grins, delighted, as if she has waited whole ages of the world to be asked this question.
Really, really?
Oh, yes. No more need to whisper now that the foundations have connected, and as my transplants choose themselves. Thank you for asking, fragment of Lenape Hoking, or Avatar of the Bronx, or whatever you prefer to be called. My name is Relaye. Can you say it?
It's a shivery-sounding name, one that makes Bronca's inner ears twitch and the roots of every hair follicle crawl. But while the name is otherwise meaningless to her, she sees from the corner of her eye that Queen's eyes widen as she mouths, "Oh, fuck." Then the woman in white giggles suddenly and pantomimes holding something like a broomstick in front of herself. In a pretend gruff voice, she says,
"You shall not pass."
Always wanted to say that. And you shan't, you disgusting creatures. Pieces of this monstrous, murdering city, pieces of shit. Staten Island has chosen to do what is right, and I will not let you interfere with her decision. So let's rumble, boroughs of New York, soul of Hong Kong. Isn't that what you call it? A rumble? Somewhere beneath them, there's a deep, reverberating roil of sound, like a thunderstorm far below ground. Bronca catches her breath, thinking of the Bronx Arts Center and the tower that consumed it, but nothing rises beneath them. It's just a sound for now. Just a rumble. And before them, grinning so widely that they can see nearly all of her teeth, the living embodiment of the city of Relia spreads her long-fingered, long-nailed, elegant white hands in open invitation. Come then, city that never sleeps. Let me show you what lurks in the empty spaces, where nightmares dare not tread. Chapter 15. And lo, the beast looked upon the face of beauty. The cab ride is smooth and uneventful the whole way. Even Madison remarks on it. Huh? I'd heard there was some kind of protest on FDR. It's always the FDR, right? Forcing people to make all kinds of detours. But I haven't seen a single alternate route sign. Even feels like the traffic is getting out of our way. Manny, who has noticed the faint aura limning the windows and visible exterior of the cab, glances at Paolo, who nods.
Well, you said your cab liked me, Manny says. Thanks for giving us a ride, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, Madison says. She sounds amused rather than annoyed. Only reason I'm headed this way is because the mayor wants to do some kind of old New York, new New York photo shoot tomorrow. You're lucky as hell, dude.
Paolo nods again. Cities make their own luck, apparently. Getting into the old City Hall station is almost too easy once Madison has dropped them off at the vaulted, colonnaded entrance to the Brooklyn Bridge City Hall subway stop. There are cops clustered all around it, and Manny sets his jaw ready for unpleasantness as he and Paolo approach. Three of the cops have visible white tendrils jutting from necks or shoulders. Two of the ones who don't, however, move to intercept the tendrilled ones when they make noises at Manny about not letting anyone into the station due to an apparent bomb threat.
"Let him through," says a woman who seems to outrank all the rest. She's in plain clothes and seems to be barely paying attention to anything, instead flipping through a sheaf of papers on a clipboard.
"They're here to fix things."
These guys don't look like Con Ed engineers,
says one of the intercepting cops. The tendril that juts from his left cheekbone is as thick as an electrical cable. The plainclothes woman fixes him with a glare.
There's some reason why I have to tell you things twice, Martinburg?
No, I just...
Did I ask for your opinion, Martinburg?
He protests again, and she tells him off again, eventually lowering the clipboard and squaring off to establish her dominance. While the two cops' companions watch the combatants, Manny and Paolo walk into the station unmolested.
"Want to tell me what just happened there?" Manny asks as they walk. "Because we really don't look like Con Ed.
Those who would help protect the city see what they need to see."
"Well, all righty then." The six trains aren't running, shut down due to police investigation.
They pass a few more cops, MTA engineers, some uniformed people who might be Homeland Security, and some actual Con Ed engineers. But no one else stops them, or even seems to see them. These people thin out as Manny and Paolo descend to the train platform, but the tunnels amplify their laughter and jokes. It's clear they're not worried about any bomb. Manny can't see any signs of construction. Someone in authority has simply shut the station down for no clear reason. On the platform, an empty train sits with doors open and no conductor inside. "Do we just wait?" Manny says, stepping into the lead car. Paolo sits down opposite the conductor's booth, but Manny can't hear that there's no one in it. He stands at the train's forward window, peering into the dark that awaits down a curving, downward-angled tunnel corridor. "If you wait, will it go?" Paolo asks. It seems a sincere and not sardonic question, so Manny doesn't bristle. In fact, it belatedly occurs to him that Paolo is trying to teach him something. And after a moment, as he feels the powerful nearby tug of the primary, he gets it. So he takes a deep breath and puts his hands on the smooth metal that surrounds the window. He's only ridden a subway once before, but he makes himself remember that sensation now, as he did at the Bronx Art Center. The power of unseen, relentless engines driven by the mysterious and deadly third rail. The rocking, hectic speed. The driving needs of hundreds of people riding within to get to important places for important reasons, to have a warm place to sleep, to keep them safe along the way. Safe, he thinks at the primary and at the train that surrounds them. Yes, I'm coming to keep you safe now. "Stand clear of the closing doors, please," he whispers. In the reflection of the glass behind him, he sees Paolo smile. The PA system utters a little ding-dong tone, and then the train's doors slide shut. There is a faint hum from the undercarriage as the train turns on and its engines warm. In the tunnel up ahead, a signal switches from red to green. Then slowly, the train jolts into motion. Manny's half expecting someone to come running onto the platform to try to stop them. But it's New York. If any of the personnel in the station hear the train start moving, they dismiss it as normal background noise, more familiar than the strange silence of before. So Manny's six glides unmolested into the tunnel. And then, surprisingly quickly, they are at the old City Hall station platform. Manny turns to the door as the train slows and then stops of its own volition. It knows where it needs to go better than he does. When the doors slide open, the platform beyond is pitch dark. The defunct station has no power. Manny can make out glass skylights on the ceiling here and there, the same pattern of Beaux-Arts ironwork that he saw in Branca's books, and a bit of moonlight coming through them. The light from the train car helps, but even this fades as they walk away from the train and into the bowels of the station. Manny fumbles in his pocket for his phone and turns on its flashlight. It's barely enough to illuminate more than a foot-wide circle on the stone floor ahead of them. He hasn't charged it since Inwood, and the battery's getting low. Better than nothing. When they're a couple of feet past the subway train's circles of illumination, the train's lights suddenly go out with a loud electrical snap. In spite of himself, Manny jumps. But he doesn't need his eyes to know where to go. Not anymore. He can feel it. "This way," he says. He feels Paolo latch onto the back of his jacket, letting Manny take the lead. "We must be careful," Paolo says. "It was necessary that we come here. But the enemy has seen us." Manny grimaces, thinking of the tendrilled cops. "It will know now that its target is here." Manny sets his jaw. "Roger that." There's a set of steps after about 20 paces. Shining the flashlight around, Manny finds that it leads into an arched stairwell. A sign on the arch, etched in green tile, proclaims that they stand within the station of City Hall. The ceiling of the arch is covered in marching, elegant, white Guastavino tile patterns. Manny follows the stairs up, barely noticing as Paolo barks his toes on a step and mutters some imprecation in Portuguese. The sound of their footsteps and breathing whispers back at him from the arches of the ceiling. In his mind, the whisper forms words. Here, here, here. And at last, at last, at last. And then he turns the corner. It is both like and unlike his vision. There is the bed of old bundled newspapers. Its occupant lies amid a pool of pale moonlight, still and curled, his breathing so slow that it's barely visible. Just a too thin young black man in worn cheap clothing, sleeping on trash like a homeless person. And yet, he radiates power. Manny shivers as waves of it ripple along his skin, feeding something within him that he had begun to starve. Here, at last, the most special person in the whole city. Without thinking, Manny moves closer and puts out a hand to shake him awake. He needs to touch him, but a few feet from the primary avatar's shoulder, Manny's hand halts in the air. Something resists the gesture, as if his hand pushes against a sponge that he cannot see or feel. He tries again harder and makes a frustrated sound when, after a little give, the unseen resistance goes as hard as concrete. He cannot touch the primary. So eager to be eaten? Paolo's soft voice startles Manny into turning sharply. He'd actually forgotten Paolo was there for a moment, and then he twitches with the reminder. I didn't think about the eating thing, he admits. It makes him want to touch the primary a little less, but only a little. Paolo's not much more than an etching in the dark, illuminated more by reflected moonlight than Manny's phone light. He's watching Manny, though, and his sadness is visible. I'm his, Manny blurts. It's defensive, but he's feeling a little raw right now. He's mine. Paolo inclines his head in acceptance. I will admit some envy, he says gently. To be part of a group going through this together is astonishing to me, and wonderful in many ways. I went through my own rebirth alone, like most cities. It's a perspective shift that Manny wasn't expecting. You knew him then, before? He gestures at the bed of newsprint. Of course, that's how it usually works. The youngest city sees to the next. Paolo sighs a little into the dark. It should have been Port-au-Prince, but I was happy to see this one make it through, until he fell into my arms and then vanished. Manny considers this as he gazes down at the sleeping figure. He tries to imagine the primary, awake, vibrant, able to laugh and dance and run, and it's easy. He's so vibrant now, even asleep. But then Manny imagines his vibrancy muted, voice undergirded with the same loneliness that all of them have noticed in São Paulo. And it hurts to think of it. Even though it means Manny's death, he can't help thinking, I'm sorry we'll leave you so alone. What is he like? Manny finds himself whispering. In the close, quiet confines of the alcove, even this carries. He can actually hear Paolo smile. Arrogant, angry, frightened, but unwilling to let his fear restrict him. After a moment, Paolo moves around the bed of papers to the primary's other side. He's smiling down at the boy with unmistakable fondness. He pretends to be less special than he is, because the world has punished him for loving himself. And yet he does. He knows he's more than whatever superficialities strangers see and dismiss. Is that what the city of New York is like? Manny's been here 3 days, but it feels right so far. He sighs. It's a shame. He really wanted to make a life here. He looks up at Paolo. I need the others to touch him. Yes, I can see that. We must rely on your comrades and Huang then. Manny's lip curls. I'll rely on my comrades. Huang can go to hell. Paolo laughs once. Don't be too hard on him, he says, to Manny's surprise. Before he was a city, he lived through the opium wars. He's watched so many die. Cities, as well as ordinary people, that his attitude is understandable, if infuriating. Manny frowns, trying to remember what he can of Chinese history. Jesus, that's... Huang is almost 200 years old? What, are we immortal? Unless we're eaten. No. No.